I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Betty Baxter joins me now. She's just published a memoir, Outspoken, A Journey from Olympic Athlete to Activist. In the book, she recounts her experiences growing up in a small town in Alberta to finding sport and going on to play volleyball, representing Canada abroad, even playing in the 1976 Olympics. The book narrates the reality of sports then as now, and how there are inequities that still need addressing. In 1980, Baxter becomes the first woman to coach the Canadian women's volleyball team, but in January 1982, at the age of 29, she was fired because of rumors about her sexual orientation. There was never a question of misconduct, which surrounded some of her male colleagues, one should note. She talks about that and the devastating effect it had on her career, and even how she viewed sports themselves. I'll ask Betty about why she wrote the book and what she's had to work through over the years. For a while, because of the firing, she couldn't even set foot in a gymnasium. She felt so unmoored by the firing. I'll ask Betty about leadership, too, and about the 1990 Gay Games, which she played an important part in bringing to Vancouver. Betty Baxter also initiated the National Coaching School for Women and founded Canadian Women and Sport. After her expulsion in 1982 as Canada's national coach, she became an outspoken activist for the 2SLGBTQIA+ community and human rights. In 1993, she was the first open lesbian to seek federal office in Vancouver Centre. And in 2011, she was elected to her local school board, serving two terms. This new book is published by Knightwood Editions. We spoke last week with Betty joining me from Roberts Creek, British Columbia. Please welcome to the Plant on Land program, Betty Baxter. Betty, good morning.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Nice to talk to you. You know, what's heartening when I read the book, because you say this at the end of the book, that in your 70th year, you were getting so much recognition for sporting activities in your 20s that you never expected that. And I found that, I don't know, it sort of broke my heart that it took that long, but better late than never, I guess. Is that any comfort at all?
Well, you know, I think there was a point where I just thought, you know, sport isn't the good place that I had hoped it would be. Mm. I still believe sport's hugely valuable and has tremendous potential. But there was a place where I walked away, and I do talk about that a bit in the epilogue, that I just thought, I can't put more time in this. So I had kind of written it off, and it wasn't even better late than never. It was kind of a surprise. Oh, there's people here who want to see me as acceptable after all. And that was a very gratifying feeling. And, you know, it's kind of like when you finally let go, then things come back and they have a different glow or a different positive light to them.
Yeah, that's the other thing that annoyed me or upset me a lot as I was reading the book, is that you did have to turn your back, and there were a number of incidents. Obviously, you know, the book opens with this scene where you're fired because of your sexual orientation, and there was another scene later that you write about. I guess it was in the 90s in Victoria.
Yes.
Where a fellow instructor, I guess, had this incorrect assumption about why you were fired in 1982. That was another powerful moment, was it, where you decided that I'm not going to devote any more time to sports or organized sports in Canada, I guess, right?
Yeah, and you know, I'm really glad you raised that, because a lot of people go right blow past that, and yet that was the moment. That was the most disheartening moment. Like, when it's kind of like somebody punches you, you get up, you go, okay, you know, I can figure this out. I can work. I can get through this. But when the people who claimed to support me actually believed that I was dishonorable and was doing things that I was teaching and hoping people would learn not to do, especially around athlete abuse, because I'll be really frank, Joe, that is what made me write this book. I listened to the Heritage Committee in 2022, and I thought, I can't believe how many of these people are finally able to tell the stories of their painful experiences in sport. And that was the moment for me when the allies who I thought could help me change the system, I was like the eternal optimist, you know, knock me down, I'm going to get up and change it, knock me down, I'm going to get up and change it. But then when I saw the people who were supporting me actually didn't believe in the change. I was just as creepy as anybody else. That was horrifying, to be honest. It was horrifying.
The other thing I noticed, Betty, as I was reading the book, you know, whether it was the people that fired you at CVA, the Canadian Volleyball Association, in 1982, or this particular instructor in Victoria in 1991, you don't name names. And I guess I guess I was hoping that you would, but specific?
That
or?
Was by design. And in some ways, you know, it got clear to me. I was kind of following my gut. Several editors said, you've got to name these people. You've got to name these people. And I just felt like I wasn't writing the book for any kind of individual, you know, retribution or vindictiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing the book because I want people to know this stuff happens, and first, you can get through it. Like, you can do good things in your life, even if people don't believe you're a good person at some horrible moral level. But I also wanted the sports system. I wanted the book to be about the way the system doesn't honor individuals or the athlete, and how the system can roll along with, in fact, unethical and, you know, immoral activities, and nobody calls it. So, you know, those men could have been three other men in a different sport, or that individual prof in Victoria could have been one of a dozen people across the country. It wasn't about them as individuals. It was about a system where nobody will call out the bad, and nobody will say this will never happen again. And you only have to look to, you know, our soccer or hockey recent scandals to see that they become a culture, and there might be good individuals in the middle of that culture, but they don't stand up and say, I will not stand for this. And so I really didn't want it to be about people. And there's one other point I'll make on that, and that just came to me when a journalist who was going to do a blurb for me said, you know, I really wanted you to name these people. I had been a college volleyball player, and I recognized who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, when I got legal advice before I was fired, the lawyer told me, if they fire you because you're gay, they have to prove it. And that means they have to investigate. And that may be a horrifying experience for you personally and for anybody you've associated with in your time in Ottawa. And so I thought, that's about compromising other people's lives. And so I wasn't, you know, it was unfair, it was gut-wrenching, but I didn't want other people to be drawn into the same kind of morass that I had found myself in. And she was, the journalist in particular, came back to me and said, I never considered that, how when you're considered to be morally evil, if you're investigated and the people you associate with are investigated, it's kind of like the communist purge in the McCarthy areas. You know, like everybody is subject to some kind of scrutiny that's completely irrational. So I didn't want the book to be anywhere close to about that. I wanted it to be about the ways I recovered and regained a strong sense of self, and the ways that the system never really opened up and changed. There's been improvements, but you can still be an abuser in the sports system and get away for years with behaving very badly.
We'll talk about the culture in sport today in a moment, but you know, you were fired in 1982. I was born in 1982, and
wow.
in reading the book in 2026, you know, I found it horrifying in terms of you know, these reasons that these men gave you for firing you. But it was very much a different time, wasn't it, 43 years ago, right?
It's completely, in fact, when I got the contract for the book with Knightwood, their editor is a young mom in her 40s, and she had just read a story, I think it was Devin Hero from CBC, that had done a story about two professional women hockey players that were married.
Uh-huh.
And she said, I don't get why this is a story.
Yeah.
And I just looked at her and said, you need to get into my book, because, you know, it's a story that people can stand up and be who they are and not face retribution every single day based on their faith community, their personal, you know, home community, their sport community, their business community. We have come a long way, but I don't think many young people, your age and younger, really know how evil it could be and how hard it was for people who didn't have the support or the wherewithal to be able to say, I will not be a secret. I will not deny who I am.
I guess,
was very fortunate. I had a family that loved me, and that made a big difference.
Yeah, I want to talk about your family in a moment, but I guess a lot of people my age, even younger, take a lot of these things for granted. And in the last line of the book, I found so powerful that with this rise in hate that we're seeing in the world today, it puts so many of these gains in peril, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think people don't realize that. I mean, in some ways, I say in the epilogue, same-sex marriage in 2005 did a huge thing to legitimize it. Frankly, I wasn't in support of same-sex marriage. I thought it was sort of one more state intervention in people's lives and financial accountability. But I didn't foresee how much it would make kind of a mainstream cultural acceptance. Mm. And that's been powerful. But there's still many countries in the world where homosexuality is punished by death. And I think the struggles in our neighbors to the south about basically, I guess you call it authoritarianism, it's the people who have the least capacity to fight back. And I will say trans people. I mean, my story is not a trans story, but they are probably the most marginalized people in the country. And yet they're the ones who are getting the most vocal attacks. And it's a made-up issue. They don't even exist in the numbers to validate any kind of oppression. But they're targeted because they don't have the capacity to fight back.
Yeah, that's the important lesson in the book, is that, yes, we have come so far since 1982, but in mere months, everything could change,
Yeah, exactly. And I guess, I think what helped me survive is I'm a big believer in community.
Mm.
If you come from a small town, it's way more important if you're a good neighbor than how you pray or who you love or how much money you make. And that's where our strength comes from, and yet I think this kind of rising separation of, that population is to blame or that population is to blame or it's foreign workers or it's immigration, it only separates us, and we will never overcome some of the challenges that we face today if we're separate. I'm a firm believer in that. It's not just a love thy neighbor. It's like, open the doors, let people play, let people talk, let people get to know each other and care for each other. And that was really, in the last chapter of the book, that's what I wanted people to see from Celebration 90, that when there was no rules, everybody played and it was safe and glorious.
Yeah, that's the thing, that chapter on the gay games of 1990, I found fascinating, was that, there was obviously opposition then. And then it is a great success despite all that. And yet, if you tried to do that today, there would be just as many challenges, if not more.
I agree with you, and to be honest, I've given that quite a bit of thought. I think we were lucky because we were so, I'm going to use the word ecstatic, that we could actually dare to do it. And we gained kind of a groundswell of public support from people of all kinds of backgrounds. I think today the threats of violence would be far more visceral.
Yeah.
And I think the city might not be able to be as safe as it was in 1990. And that saddens me a great deal. I mean, I'm thrilled the gay games are still existing. They're a little bit more elitist. You have to have money and the class ability to get to them. Their whole game goal was not to be political, but I think that it's not quite as wide open a door as it had been in terms of those early days. I guess most revolutions are kind of like that. The early days are pretty heady.
And then they become sort of establishment, don't they?
to be honest, I think that's true. And then, I have great faith in young people being able to figure out how to rock the boat again, but I think that kind of euphoric joy in 1990 would have been really hard to get now because there's a lot more insidious campaigns. And maybe that's in part the Internet's been the great equalizer, but it's also enabled people to come together when they have really quite vicious agendas.
Well, one of the great lessons in that chapter, or it's not just one chapter, but when you talk about the gay games in terms of organizing, the event here in Vancouver, you don't only have to need, have to have the savvy in terms of organizing, because a lot of you and the other people with you had that. But you also saw firsthand the courage that all of you had in doing that, didn't you?
It was, and I was actually quite astonished. Like that chapter, the little tiny scene where I talk about the police wanting to tell us that they'd had individual threats.
He had to move a soccer place.
Yeah. They wanted us to move it, and we didn't, which, you know, again, that was Strathcona Park where there was bushes all around and it was, you know, not easily accessible if there would be an emergency. But we, in some ways it was naivety. We thought, you know, we have people coming, there's a trust issue, the people believe we can do this, and if we suddenly start to react out of fear, it will snowball. And I remember feeling in that room, we didn't know what everybody was going to say, and yet people were very afraid, and we all said, we can't stop. And it's kind of like it moved me today, even though it's like, however, 40-some years later, that we were all different people. We didn't know each other very well. We weren't personal friends, but we all said, we have to do it. And, you know, that we thought about, I mean, I lived in Kitsilano in a duplex at the time, and I thought about, what if somebody comes to my home? How could I be safe? But I couldn't go there. I couldn't even make a plan because we were in the midst of this, the final kind of 5 or 6 days. And we just all said yes, and it was a profound moment. And, you know, the young man, I quote him a couple times, Mark Neese, who was our executive director, he was in his late 20s, and he was just worried that we would say, change something, because he was putting his whole life, he'd quit his job so that he could do it. You know, he became, I think he's a vice president with Air Canada, he's probably retired now, but he had a very successful administrative career in the airline industry, and I just think, you know, there's a guy that just wanted to do the right thing, and he was successful in his life, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's another one of the great lessons that one can take from reading this book. You mentioned your family. I want to talk about your mom in particular.
Yeah.
There's a marvelous scene at the beginning of the book. I guess your parents had picked you up for Sunday brunch.
Yeah.
And you had been out drinking the night before and a little worse for the wear, if you will.
I was in sorry shape Sunday morning.
And so your mom is in the car, and she sends your sister, your younger sister, and your dad into this brunch, I guess it was being hosted by friends.
Yeah.
And she wants to keep you in the car because she wants to talk to you. What does she tell you at that moment?
Well, you know, I was nervous because I was hungover. I didn't feel good. I'd been so angry to get drunk, and I just was going to, you know, I was 19. I was going to be the boss of my own life, and I just, you know, let everybody have it the night before. And there's my mom and dad staying with good friends of the family who I knew. But my mom was that kind of person. She did not have an easy life. But she was like, you never duck away from something bad. You figure it out and get through it. So when she asked me to get in the back, and, you know, my sister was very nervous because, again, kids sat in the back in our family.
Yeah.
She knew that it was something big. And when she got me in the back, I thought I was just going to get a lecture, you know, kind of like a teenage, you better pull up your socks and behave yourself.
Yeah.
But when she looked at me and said, you don't have to do this for us. I mean, I can almost tear up again now. You don't have to do this for us. We want you to do it because you love it. Can you make your decisions based on that from now on? Well, of course, I'm hungover. I've had no sleep. All I want to do is just bawl my eyes out. And she won't, she's looking at me, and she won't look away until I look at her. So, you know, I look at her and nod. And then she gives me this hug, just enough that I'm not going to break down, just a hug. And then she gives me the lesson of the day and says, now go in, get into the washroom, and clean yourself up. This family's made us a nice meal. Go get presentable. So I don't get to duck my responsibilities, but my mom gives me permission to have to figure out how to do something I love in a way that's not destructive. And, you know, that's who she was. I have to say, my mom was a towering person in terms of character.
Yeah, she's just a wonderful character that you write about in the book. And then, you know, there's a funny story later on when you come out to her. And and it's very recently, isn't it, that you found her journals, I guess, where she was writing at that time?
Yes. And so it was last summer. I was at my brother's home, and he had all her journals. And, you know, various people in the family wanted to read them and kind of find out what she wrote about them.
Sure.
It's amazing because she kept journals from, like, the late 1930s until 1980s.
Wow.
And the 1982, when I'd been fired in January, I was trying to, I'd had this short contract after being fired, because literally when I was fired, I had 10 minutes to leave the building, but you know, the powers of sport gave me another short contract to kind of give me some funds to get through and figure out my life. So fired in January, I left Ottawa in May, and I was coming across the country, stopping at family and basically coming out to them because I had to make that decision. I was not going to be a person that was ashamed of myself. And in my mother's kitchen, I mean, you have to know my dad. My dad was a construction worker. He owned his own small company, and he was the kind of guy that came in, you know, read the newspaper, was in the TV, and would come and sit down when dinner was ready and then leave the table and go back to the living room.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that he stayed and got up to do the dishes, I was 29 years old and I'd never seen my father do the dishes in my life. But the kitchen was a contained space and he didn't want to leave the room. And for my mom to say, you know, I thought for a long time you were a lesbian, it was like complete freedom. The most fearful thing for a gay person to do is to have to tell their parents if they're afraid of rejection. And I know many, many people who have been rejected or thrown out of the house or, you know, received their baby pictures in a brown envelope torn up. Like, there are horrible things families do when they reject a child. But they didn't. They opened their arms, and then I thought, oh, life's good. And then literally last year, it would have been 2 years ago because it was before I had the contract for the book publishing, I'm reading my mom's diaries, and I learned that she had such a tough year that year. She was telling me that she loved me in May. In June, my dad had incredible arthritis in his back and was really experiencing a lot of pain. In July, she'd had kind of a conflict with some of her church members, and she was trying to sort stuff out. She was just discovering she was diabetic and needed to go on insulin. And my younger sister was dating a boy who'd left the Hutterite colony. And my mom writes in her diary that, you know, this has been a rough year. And by September, October, she's a rough year. And she says, you know, I've got to learn about homosexuality, and I have to learn about arthritis pain, and I've got to learn how to manage diabetes. And I just hope my youngest daughter doesn't make me learn the history of the Hutterites. I had to ask my younger sister if it was okay for me to put in a note about her Hutterite boyfriend.
Yeah.
But my mother was just overwhelmed with, she was 62 years old and facing all of these new things that were all challenging. And when she said, she just hoped. But I also was sad because I learned that summer when she told my aunt or when she told my other sisters about my homosexuality, that she cried, that she thought she was losing her beautiful daughter and she had to figure out how to not feel like that. And it shows that it's never a straight line, you know, and it's never easy. But as she always did, she put love first. All I felt from her was love.
Yeah, and there's a great deal of work to get there as well, isn't there?
Yeah. No, it's my mom's a hero, which is why I dedicated the book to my mom and my aunt, because they didn't have easy lives, and they were so clear about their love and their kindness to people.
Another great lesson in the book that I found just fascinating was, you know, because you were the youngest captain, weren't you?
I learned that at the time. I didn't know that before the Olympics.
Yeah, and so I'm curious to know, what are the qualities of leadership that a captain on a team needs, and especially at a young age? I mean, you have to gain, you know, a lot of people's trust, not just, you know, your fellow athletes, but you know, the coach and you know, the other higher ups, I guess, in the structure of the game. You know, there's another great scene in the book where your coach Moo Park, I guess he had called you outside because there was a visiting coach from South Korea.
Yeah,
and he was so impressed with you that he wanted to gift you his training outfit. I mean, that must have meant a great deal.
It did, and it was one of those things that I couldn't really brag about. Like, I did pride myself on how hard I worked because, you know, when you're at that level, you do your three or four sets in the drill, but sometimes there's an odd number and you get to go in again. And there'd often be folks that weren't as high up, you know, in terms of the top five or six players. They want that extra bit because they want the coach to see that they're working hard. But even though I was one of the top three or four players, I would always jump in. I just thought, you know, the more work, the better. The more work, the stronger I'll get. And so to have him, because a Korean coach is pretty reticent. He didn't have great command of the language. And also, you know, they keep themselves, the coaches kind of this aura around them. It's not like anything's personal, which I appreciated after I'd experienced what abusive coaches were like, how they abused personal relationships. So for him to call me out with this peer, another Korean coach, and say that this coach wanted to give this gift, you know, it was a huge, it was about a, three sizes too big for me. But I kept it for years because it meant that he saw what I was doing. He saw that I would work harder. And back to your question about being a captain, in this, in the Oriental countries, the captain is often either the oldest or the best player, and that's because they've already got the respect from younger players. There's more of a hierarchy around cultural age or respect. And Mu did that in his first year. He named our, clearly our most talented athlete. She was a phenomenal athlete as the captain. But she was a little younger, and she wasn't that, she was a, extremely good player and worked hard, but she wasn't that kind of person that saw the whole group. She saw her role and did it. So she wasn't really a leader. Whereas my development in my university years really set me up to be a leader. And I was, again, really gratified that he saw that in me. And so he switched the captain, which they hardly ever do.
Yeah.
But then I knew that my responsibility was to make sure that this team worked and to talk to the media and to be positive with the hosts at various countries and sometimes to represent the team to receive, you know, gifts or make a short speech. And I was suited for that. I was comfortable in that role, although it was not always easy.
Yeah. And so this goes into the transition to coaching. I mean, it just seems like it would be a natural progression. What, did you see it at the time as that?
No, mostly because the average age at that time in the late 70s of the international teams was somewhere between 25 and 28. I think Russia's team's average age was 26, 27. And we had lots of players, like one player across from us, sometimes playing the Eastern Bloc countries, had two or three kids. I mean, they were, we were babies in some ways, much younger average age. So I was so committed. I saw that, you know, we were playing people that were in their early 30s. I thought that, man, give me another 4 years, I will really understand this game and I'll know how to do it. But I was shocked to be cut at the peak of my career. Like, you know, they wouldn't have cut Wayne Gretzky when he was at his top scoring. You know?
Yeah.
But again, that's the, he was a Korean. He didn't think that the athletes would stay with the program, and he became actually what he, his gift to Canada was, he actually developed a whole stream of younger players that fed the national team long after he was the coach. So he saw that Canada didn't have a system and that it needed a system for younger players. So part of, I hope, what people get from the book is that we have a sports system that doesn't respect the athletes having any agency in their own lives.
Yeah.
Or that respects their individual choice around their contribution. So to me, to go back to coaching was more a default because I'd had a good experience when I was in graduate school. It was like, to be honest, I was 26 years old. I'd never had anything except, you know, those after-school high school jobs. I'd always just been focused on getting to the Olympics and being an international athlete.
There are marvelous memories in the book about the travel involved. I mean, you go to China, you go to Japan, a lot of these Eastern European countries as well. And this is in the 1970s when these weren't places that people could, say, holiday to.
Exactly. I think when I counted, I think I named 8 or 9 countries that we traveled to, but literally that was just a handful. I mean, I don't even name, I named Mexico, but we went to Mexico half a dozen times. I don't even name Hungary or Poland or East Germany. But it was a remarkable experience. And to be honest, Joe, at the beginning, I thought I would write a travel log. I didn't really want to write my personal story. I thought, man, I should write about these trips because we learned so much and we saw so many things. And then the other writers in my writing group kept saying, but why were you there and what were you doing? And, you know, finally one of them said, you know, this is an effing memoir. You just need to write the memoir. I was like, oh, my, do I have to? So it was a good thing because it became a richer story when people learned about how I had to grow as well as travel to all these wonderful places.
And so when you're a coach and you're in charge of, say, players, what was your, how did you, say, manage Because you were obviously managing their time at practice and during mm-hmm. the games and the sort. How did you view their personal time off? Were you pretty strict? Say they could, especially in these foreign countries where there's an adventure outside the dorm or whatever, right?
Well, to be honest, because of the 1980 Olympic boycott in Moscow, my first year as a coach was very limited to domestic travel, and then we went to Europe to two or three countries. For the International Student Games. And then when I came home, I was fired. So it was only really that one trip that I managed people on the road. But in my university coaching, both at the University of Alberta and the University of Ottawa, I kind of established this code of conduct where I wanted them to be responsible all of their life, but I wanted them to recognize that they were making those choices, that the team had really strict rules when we were training or traveling or competing. And that's why there's the story about the kids drinking alcohol, because I wanted them to know that this is not a party scene, there is no alcohol, and we have strict rules when we're on team time. When you're away from team time and you're having a birthday party or going out for beers after exams or whatever, you can make your own choices. But when you show up to practice, be it the next day or 2 days later, you're on team time, and you need to be, clean and sober and ready to do your job. And that worked extremely well. I had a couple individuals that challenged me the first year, and when there was a consequence, and the consequence was never a discipline, it was more just harder work because you clearly weren't quite ready to work hard. And the consequence on the second trip when we were in Holland, and in Holland it's very difficult because there's a bar in every sports gym. So when the athletes were waiting with their host teams. Of course, their host teams invited them to sit down for a beer. Very different cultural environment than going to the pub in North America. So the fact that they were disciplined for doing that, it might have been a bit harsh, but I was a very young coach. It was my first international trip with a university team. And I thought, if I don't nip this now, but the reason I tell that story in the book is that I told them, the team makes the rules, and if anybody breaks the rules, I'll enforce them, but the team has the right to change the rules. You know, whether or not I would stay as their coach might come in question if they didn't want rules that were good rules. And I never, ever, even though I was a very young coach, I was at the time like maybe 23, 24, 24, I never had a challenge on that. They accepted that it was fair. I wouldn't interfere with their personal life. They could make their own choices. They had to know when they came to do the team's job, they were 100% there, and if they weren't, there'd be a consequence. And it worked as a very good disciplinary kind of environment to set up a seriousness that hadn't been there before I started as coach.
It's another marvelous lesson in the book. I want to go back to the firing in 1982 for just a moment, because, again, as you recount in the book, there's a lot of pain there. And it unmoors you for a number of years. You couldn't even step into a gymnasium at one point, right?
It was physical. It was almost like a physical illness. And, it's interesting I'm having this call today, because last night my friend Kim, who was a very large gay man that was a volleyball player, he phoned me last night because he's going to come to my book launch. And I credit him. He just hounded me until I would agree to coach. And I was terrified. I mean, it was for me to go to UBC, where I had been so comfortable as an athlete, but to go to that gym as a coach, it really felt like I would be either shot or lit on fire, that the level of pain was so high that I had to go the night before, because I was so physically afraid of what could happen. And people could say maybe I didn't have much emotional self-control or management, but that's how deep the fear was, because I had lost the thing that I loved, which was my job coaching. And here was someone asking me to go into that arena again. And also, UBC had not hired me, so there was a toxicity there. But I give Kim a lot of credit for that, because, like I said, he was a very large guy. And when I started to coach, he was there and he watched me as a friend. And then when the young athletes asked me would I coach a club team, it was very joyful, because there was none of the stress of having to perform. And yet when I went to any coaching meetings or any travel trips where the kind of volleyball culture, like the mainstream volleyball folks were there, mostly male coaches, he sat with me and he was so blatant. I mean, he had pins on his sweatsuit that said faggot or I'm one or gay and proud. Like he just, and he would sit beside me on the bench and just be there. And it was like my own personal bodyguard. It was, it only happened for, you know, maybe 6 months, but it really lifted me. It shows what, how important friends are when you're so vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly. Friends and family are important, aren't they?
Exactly.
And that's another great lesson in the book, how we can be that person for someone else who's, who needs it, right?
Well, it's true. And sometimes we don't even know when it's happening. You know, it's interesting. I'll take the chance if we have the time.
Sure.
I got a grant for this book to be able to give away 100 books.
Hmm.
And I'm giving them to small libraries and youth activist groups. And I was working on a sort of municipal electoral workshop, Saturday. And a young black woman was there who was, you know, actually magnificent looking. She was long dreadlocks and about 6'2" and proud and, you know, strong in her body. And she was there because she wanted to learn about local politics. And she's 18. She's in last year high school. And I was so impressed. Everybody that came in the room or said something, she would walk up, even the woman that delivered the pizzas for lunch, she walked up and shook her hand and said, thank you so much for your support today. And I thought, I'm going to go to that woman and give her a book. You know, I don't know where she lives, but I know her mom works at a public market on the Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go and give her the book because I want her to know that even if you get knocked down, regardless of the reasons, you can always get up and you can always have support. And she just was, I was so impressed with this young person who, you know, there's lots of people that will discount her because of her race or because she's a very large, tall young woman.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to do whatever I can to tell her, you know, good on you. You go out there and change the world.
You do write, Betty, about the problem with sports in Canada today. I mean, you mentioned the Heritage Report in 2022, Hockey Canada, obviously, is it, we hear them in the news all the time, Soccer Canada. This culture of silence is the insidious thing that I want to talk about, because this is something that you saw 45 years ago or more, 50 years ago now, and it's still there. And, you know, there's a great deal to change in sport, but I guess I'm wondering, you know, how do we start?
Well, one of the things I did with the encouragement from Bruce Kidd, who I sent Bruce Kidd my book, and he's been just incredibly supportive. Do you know who Bruce Kidd is?
No, but the name sounds familiar, though. But
Bruce Kidd was an Olympic long-distance runner, middle-distance runner, in the Munich Olympics in 1972. And then he became a prof at the University of Toronto in sport sociology and sport history.
Mm.
And I knew his sister a bit, but I contacted him when the book was coming out to say, would you read the book and do a blurb for me? And he said, this is such an important book for sport history, and he's lined up some talks for me and been really helpful promoting the book since. One of the things he did, as soon as I got him the media copies, is he sent copies of the book to the Maisonneuve Commission on Sport that's due to report this April, so that those commissioners have a copy of the book to look at what was happening in the 70s and 80s and compare with the stories they've heard in these last 3 years, because they are the commission that sort of got started after that Heritage Committee testimony.
Yeah.
So at least the book is in the hands of the people who will make recommendations. And I think the other part that I'm trying in my life and everything I do is to encourage people to speak up. Like I, even in meetings, you know, in this workshop we had on the weekend, there's people who see someone in conflict or who see someone in a committee meeting or a community meeting, put someone else down based on race or gender, and they know it's wrong, but they're afraid to rock the boat.
Right.
And I'm a big believer in rocking the boat. You have to say, I'm uncomfortable with that. Even if you don't know how to articulate it, you have to say, I don't think this is right. I think we have to have a conversation. And I think in sport, if we did that and we listened to athletes, and if coaches listened not to parents that are saying, I want my child to play more, but to parents who are saying, why is such and such and such and such, you know, not getting a strong spot on the team? I think there's places to have more conversations. And if a coach spends too much time with your son or daughter, pay attention.
Mm.
If a coach ignores your son or daughter, pay attention. And the best thing a parent can do is to help their son or daughter get better by playing with them, getting involved with the team, giving them more actual parental support, rather than saying, oh, that kid is too big, or that kid must be transgender because they're a lot larger than everybody else on the team. Like, the blaming doesn't let the system get better. The blaming continues to separate people. So I would love to see people talk more about the experience. Sport, especially for women, can be so empowering to learn how joyful it feels to be in touch with your body and be able to achieve something with your body. It's women learn to basically hate their bodies or to make their body something other than it is. It's not a good storyline in many places for women and their bodies.
And you do give a list in the book about these things that need to change. You know, you mentioned the lack of personal agency that needs to change in sport, the role of the coach, the authority of the coach. Two other things that I'd like to reflect on, if you will, the lack of funding. Because you do talk in the book about your own personal finances throughout this, you know, whether you're a student at UBC or after you get fired later on. Also, the access to resources like physical and mental helps for athletes. I mean, that's something that needs to be available for
It's huge, and I think this recent, even the coverage of the recent Olympics in February, it showed that many of those athletes, if they weren't in the top sponsored, high-profile athletes that get the media coverage, those athletes are paying their own equipment or they're paying their own travel, perhaps not for the Olympics. But I remember while I was writing the book, I read about two women bobsled athletes, one that had $10,000 on her MasterCard because she had to get new sled blades, and she couldn't afford it, so she was carrying the debt. And the other was going to Salt Lake City for an Olympic trials, like literally representing Canada to see if she can make the time to make the Olympics, and sleeping in a church basement because she can't afford a hotel.
Mm.
So I think that Canada has to make some choices. Of course, it costs money, but we have to figure out either we compete in less sports or we completely shrink the administration. Many of those sports now are behemoth kind of hierarchies of administrative structures. And yet we have to have good grassroots sport to produce high-level athletes, and high-level athletes need money to get the competition. I am hopeful that the pro sports leagues for women's soccer and women's hockey will bring a new ethic, because they have been founded on a different ethic than the high-paying male sports leagues. I'm not a big fan of pro sports because I think they commodify people's bodies. But I think the ethic of these two new women's pro leagues is quite different. They're talking about more freedom for the athletes, more power for the athletes, and that may influence the systems.
Yeah.
But amateur sport in Canada is really a cobbled-together, chaotic system that needs some definitive priorities that the government has to set, because you can't just throw another $100 or $200 million at it. You have to figure out how is this money. I mean, my personal view might be radical, is that, you know, if a government sports agency has more than five people who are making $150,000 a year, they need to cut three of them or four of them and put that money direct in athletes' programs.
That makes a lot of sense.
Because they are, and they do need admin, there's no doubt. There's lots of admin to do. But they've become these kind of self-fulfilling organizations. And I do see some improvement on their websites, like better objective standards to make the team, criteria that lower coaches can help their athletes meet. But to me, when somebody's making, you know, six figures or more, and their whole focus is the profile of the sport and the gold medal, and not the development of the athlete, that money's going the wrong places.
And they're probably not getting the right visas when they're traveling. That's a marvelous story in the book, and especially thinking about, you know, it's during the Cold War, you're on a train, and then you have to get off the train at, you know, in the middle of the night.
I have to say, of all the times in my life, when, you know how you've got the deer in the headlights expression? I have to say, watching those people, because in Romania, everybody was always shouting at everybody, so there was a highly emotive way of communicating.
Yeah.
But to have this male usher, whatever you call them, the ticket taker on the plane, yeah. and this female who was clearly some sort of highbrow Communist Party member, yelling at each other, and me knowing, I think this might be trouble, and what the heck am I going to do to get these 16 athletes someplace safe? I remember every absolute word of that conversation.
This is just such a marvelous book because there's so many important things that we need to know, and then there's these marvelous stories of memorable characters like your mom, and then you know this adventure on the train and the visas and the sort. Yeah. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed reading the book and talking to you today, Betty. I've kept you longer than I said I would, but
I'm so pleased to have the conversation. It's been a joy, and I'll tell you, Joe, you're my first. This is new to me. These podcasts. You're my first, and I have five more in the next 2 weeks, so really thanks for helping me kind of figure out the drill here.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Continued good luck with the book.
Take care. Bye-bye.
The book is called Outspoken, A Journey from Olympic Athlete to Activist. It's author Betty Baxter. Joining me on the line from Roberts Creek in Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunton.